Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I am Tyler Bishop, and our good friend Producer Manny is just behind the boards today because we have a special guest. And if you are a listener to The Publisher Lab podcast and you recognize the voice of this person that I'm about to bring in, it means that you hold a very special place in my heart as an OG Publisher Lab listener, because that means that you are listening up to maybe even 8 years ago, when actually a lot of people might not know this, the first iteration of the Publisher Lab podcast didn't even feature me. It featured this gentleman right here. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Cole. John.
Yeah. I feel like we should have a crowd in the background. Can you put some cans?
Yeah, we can pipe in some claps or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be funny. But anyway, thank you. It's great to be back. Even though I'm here over here in London, so we're not quite in the same studio, but hopefully everyone can hear me okay. And it's good to be back, man.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners, a quick history lesson on the Publisher Lab podcast. I feel like, you know, we've been doing it long enough. We've got a little bit of leeway with the audience to be able to take that aside. And the Publisher Lab podcast originally was, I took the lead from you. You know, I think this is a space where, as much as I spend, you know, going over a lot of things in digital, you've been working in the space for a long time. And I've learned so much from you over the years. But you were doing kind of a version of this podcast for publishers when we started working together out here in California almost 8 years ago. We did the podcast together for a long time. And then you moved back over across the pond, as they say. And yeah, the rest is history, as our listeners will understand it.
Yeah, if you go back all the way to the first editions, I used to interview publishers. So that was the format that we had, where we would just sit down and get people's story and see how they build up their site, build up their business, and just, you know, kind of sit down. And quite often, and it's a bit rough and ready back then, so maybe the audio quality might need rescrubbing, a bit like the sort of the Beatles. Did you see that, Tyler? The Beatles released another song last week.
No, how is that possible?
Basically they found some old tapes and they're able, using AI, to extract voices and to sort of scrub things together. And then basically the two remaining Beatles pulled together the song into something, and then they released it 40 years after John Lennon. But it's amazing what you can do with audio. So it's all still out there. If people want to listen,
well, you know, it is something that I think about quite a bit. The music industry is going to be a real mystery over the next probably decade. It's going to be strange. I remember a couple of years ago, Kanye West released his STEM player. It was a music player that basically would extract each element of a recording, almost like vectors for images, but for audio. And it's not unique to him. I think he thought that he invented something there. But the biggest thing with it is that, you know, that's something that AI is making possible for all music across all devices now. And that's just being able to, you know, kind of pull pieces out of existing music, not to mention the fact that now you can, you know, then layer that in and, you know, recreate someone like John Lennon's voice. There's a lot of content out in the world, both video, audio, that you can imagine, and some of it's really good and maybe never been appreciated for what it could be. It'll be really interesting to see what happens with things like music and some of the video maybe that is out there that never really got the love that it could have.
Yeah, and well, pretty much all content, if you think about it. GPT, but not wanting to gallop ahead, but you know, we've all been talking today about how the GPT announcements won't last night, or UK time anyway, and just how things are just skyrocketing in the AI space. And to be able to produce your own GPT for all the long content, for example, something that's going to be possible. Think about things like support tickets, for example, hosting, something like that. I can see things getting, utilities getting enhanced, being able to solve problems much more quickly because you need access to all data almost. And it's really exciting.
It is. And I think it's good for publishers to hear some good news around AI, because I think there's been a lot of fear and a little bit of uncertainty around the impacts of it from a negative standpoint. But I think, you know, you're starting to see ways that I think now you're going to start to understand sort of the wave of benefits that are going to come, is you're just going to see more approachable ways to implement AI in ways that have been espoused for a little while, where it makes it easier for someone maybe without a super technical background to be able to, you know, do something like, you know, have an AI that's local to their machine, that understands their file system and some of their, you know, the knowledge that maybe is proprietary to them. And
definitely.
I think things will move a lot faster, like you were saying.
Yeah, I think when you're in WordPress and you might go back to pages that you haven't looked at for, you know, a decade, and to have a GPT be able to go through all that data and interpret it and to, you know, act as a muse, I think that's really, really beneficial, because up until now, we've only really had analytics programs, and you have to be good at data. It's not an easy thing to be able to just pick up and go, oh, I know what I should write about next. And so I think all of these tools are going to be new solution publishers. I think it's going to be very important.
Yeah, I liken data a lot of times to healthy eating, where it's like everybody knows that they should do it, but it's kind of hard sometimes, you know, and you're kind of, you don't necessarily have all the options and all the analogies you can imagine there. But I do think that all of a sudden, whenever you don't have to necessarily like organize, parse through, find the meaningful data, something else can do it for you and just give you what you want out of it. You know, people always talk about like taking action. Sometimes you don't really want to take an action from data, but you still need it for something. And I think that, you know, being able to figure that out is key. And being able to figure out things is something that our good friends over at Google are pretty familiar with. So as we transition into sort of the news that's going on this week, Google's kind of it's got its own place at the top of our, you know, weekly news, John, because they're quite an important player for most of, I would imagine, our listeners and most publishers. And Google launched, so Google's rolling out the November 2023 core update, and it launched, you know, basically, as you would imagine, November 2nd, to be more exact, is when they say it started rolling out. It affects content across Google Search, including Discover and featured snippets. It's improving a different core system within the search algorithm, according to Google, and to enhance the search experience is really like that's sort of the line that they've gone with for just about everything. You know, it's the one that they have to tell legislators and whenever they're in the basic judicial process for all kinds of different things. But although it's specifically targeting news, they claim that it's only going to target or impact a very small number of sites or types of queries, which realistically, they don't need to say that. That's the case every single time. If they launched these updates that affected more than maybe 1%, I'm pretty sure they might risk losing all their users, because it would, I don't think people understand just how dramatic something like 1% of all search results actually is. But thoughts on this?
Well, same with all the platforms when they say, hey, we're just looking out to user experience. And it's funny how the needs and aims of the platform seem to align with things like that. That keeping people on Google, I think, is good for Google and probably good for user experience, not so good for content producers. And we've seen this going on for many years. At first, it was knowledge graph, then featured snippets, and we're encouraged to mark up all our content. It's inevitable. Google has to respond to the GPT phenomena. We are in a world that we have the user experience on our side. I'm talking about as a content user, and I guess as Google, that people want to search and get an answer. They are not going to suffer just one answer for the sake of things that you search for. So I think that's good. Inevitably, I think the number of no-click searches is undoubtedly going to go up. I mean, I'm only reading the runes, as it were. I get the feeling that, strangely enough, no kick searches will go up. That's my interpretation, which means Q4, more revenue for Google, and keeping people more on Google and that's leading to websites. Now, that's maybe a cynical answer, but I honestly think it's going to be along those lines, because they need to train people for our data Google and not to leave and go to GPT.
So this is something I'll let our listeners in on a little tidbit, that if you don't listen to the Publisher Lab podcast, I can promise you, you won't hear this anywhere else. And that's that Google is always going to do updates at the start of November, end of October, and before December. Well, why, you ask? Well, as you can imagine, they have a lot of data on what people search for. They also have a good idea of, you know, they have the people also search, and they've got the did you mean, or we're showing results for this, even though you typed in that. The reason why you're going to see these updates in Q4 is because that's when advertiser competition is the highest. And if they want to hit their numbers for revenue, they need to make adjustments to how results show to users so they can maximize ad impressions, both in search and on the sites. And, you know, they've gotten pretty good at this data thing, and they can, you know, it's like you were saying, John, it's magical how, you know, sometimes the user experience can align with business interests so easily, something we talked about on the last podcast. But not only that, I think your comment about no click searches is a correct one as well. I think my personal opinion, and I preface that with this because, I think when we get into SEO, we got a lot of opinions, but my experienced opinion is that I think that Google will continue to try to figure out what they can get away with. Not necessarily even nefariously, but just from a standpoint of like, what is disruptive to both users, publishers, the ecosystem? What will we tolerate in terms of how far can they go in changing the search results page to be one that's like a very Google centric experience versus one in which they, you know, are simply kind of like a quarterback for content on the internet. I don't know if you feel the same way, or if it's maybe just sort of like continued linear progression of where they've gone so far.
Ellie, the way I see it is we're a long way to go between the trust that the user will have to have in order to be able to say, hey, I want to go for a weekend in Falmouth, which is the first of the town of Southwest England. And I want to go to a hotel, find me somewhere, and for the answer to come back, yeah, I found somewhere, and it's already booked. Like that, well, what about the price? Where is it? Will I like it? Will it book the same place every time? Like, and of course, these are all things that we satisfy ourselves about when we do a Google search, because we're comparing ourselves. AI is going to be able to do that for us down the road, and that will be things like products, content, all the stuff we search for. So the abilities of the technology is going to outstrip the user behavior change, but it's going to take, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. So we have some breathing space to work this out, but I think Google are on that line where that, hey, we're a search engine. If we want to become an answer engine, we're going to have to get more interactive with our users, so that big mess where they come back and ask questions. Did you mean other people search for? You know, it gives you that back and forward a bit. And I think, you know, it's going to take a long time for people to be able to trust a machine to book them a holiday without even looking at it. So we're a long way away from that being an actual thing.
Yeah, and I think that this idea of the answer engine has been kind of like the fear of publishers for a long time. And I still don't see it. I don't see, you know, I think in a lot of ways, a search engine is the right tool for many jobs. AI is also, or, you know, like an automated chatbot that's going to give you answers to questions, is the right tool for a lot of jobs. But there's many things that I use a search engine for where I don't want an answer. I want to find an answer. I want to research myself, you know. And I think ultimately where Google, you're going to see things like, instead of trying to be an answer engine, I imagine that they're going to try to almost serve as an infinite memory database for consumers. So you can think about it from, you know, the assistant standpoint. All the big tech companies kind of tried that a little while back. I don't know that we need something that's a physical thing. I think we think of getting information from, you know, people. So it's like, oh, we need a chatbot, or we need a Siri, or we need a voice assistant. But in reality, you need to be able to have a brain that can store all the world's information. Which just so happens to be the little tagline that, you know, a little search engine called Google had when they first were a, you know, plucky little startup. So it's interesting how things have evolved. But I did find it very interesting that Google just said that they finished their mobile first indexing after almost 7 years.
Yeah, I remember when that came out, because we released some technology to help users take a desktop page and make it mobile, so it would be indexed because of Google first, mobile first. But yeah, considering it's taken them all that long, it does show how slow publishers have been to get mobile. I would, I'm assuming there's still some websites out
there. There absolutely are. You know, it's kind of funny too. I was on I think it was a government website here in the US the other day, and it was still a desktop only experience. And
that pinch and zoom thing that you kind of
it wasn't even responsive. So it's got to be used. It's not even on HTML5. And I think when I look at something like that, it's not only the speed at which the internet travels, it's the speed at which Google travels, which, you know, it's against, if Google was on the cutting edge and they were constantly updating and making these like, you know, very sort of forward web decisions in their products, you know, their business would almost certainly decline, because you have so many folks that are reliant on the web, or infrastructure that is, you know, pretty dated, and, you know, keeping everybody up to date on the quote unquote the latest version. You think about something like mobile indexing, it's like, you know, mobile is the majority of traffic on the internet now. It wasn't 7 years ago, I don't think. Still, we've kind of crossed that threshold in maybe 2016, 2017. You probably remember better than me.
I am like the old man of the internet now. What was it like in the old days, you know, before phones? Ask me my laptop. And especially when you travel in different countries, you can see the speed of adoption of more modern technologies. You can go HTML now. Remember when Flash was being retired? And it just Google is almost like the world's utility, isn't it? They can't change it too quickly. I mean, I think they've been quite bold with doing Google Store on the homepage, but I think that's born out of business necessity, rather than keeping everything clean, because people, it was one of the first just to have a sage by the middle and nothing less around it. So back in the old days before Goober, which I sort of almost do remember, because that was late 90s, I think, when the Goober Canary, late Black Sheets.
I think it was like, very late 90s is probably when you can trace back the origin. It probably really kind of caught its stride on the other side of the dot-com bubble.
Yeah, back when there were other search engines, relevant day.
Yeah. I had a search engine class at my university, which was, and it was in the mid to late 2000s. So this is not too crazy long ago. And Google was not even the search engine that we used as sort of the default, like, this is the one everybody uses, here's how to use a search engine. It was like, there's also this other like one that's real simple. People kind of like it. It might be one that gets really popular too one day, you know?
Yeah.
10 years off into the future is like when we were imagining. I think the point you made about Google and sort of like a business interest, you can kind of look at a lot of things that Google does, and the ones that seem to align with, you know, what people actually do want, those things tend to be very successful. It's the stuff that Google sort of invests a lot of time and energy into that nobody wants, but serves a Google business interest, that always seem to make it into that graveyard. And speaking of things that are taking a long time at Google, because there's always these inevitable delays. It takes 7 years to roll out mobile first indexing, not just because of the web itself, but because, you know, Google is often very slow with things like this. And the death of the third party cookie, it's got to be suffering at this point, because if it's been dying for 10 years.
yeah. Those poor cookies, they've just been left. Are we still going to be talking about this in another 2 years' time? Probably miss, right? I mean,
I don't. Honestly, at this point, I think the internet might be dead before third-party cookies.
It does feel like
the cockroaches of the internet.
Yes, that's right. They'll stick around, whereas everything else will be dead. There's only cookies left. it makes me think that by delaying it long enough, they're affecting their own business needs, which are, don't forget, they've got Android, Chrome, Google.com. And when you log into Google, they've got you with Chrome. And, you know, it doesn't seem like Google reads cookies in order to be able to show you ads. And I think, well, let body cookies to go away for them to then be selling that information. I don't think it makes business sense for Google to sell that information anyway. What they do is they just bridge the gap between their data and how much money they can charge for ads. So that's part of their pattern. And I think, yeah. I mean, we're coming on to it, I think, to talk about it later, but GDPR and preventing or trying to prevent you from any entity from tracking you around the internet is, you know, it's kind of like closing the door after the horse has bolted. You know, it's sort of, they're already tracking you in other ways. So don't worry about cookies anymore. Like, all of these pop-ups pop in Europe, every site you go to, it pops up this huge thing saying accept or et cetera. And
I didn't realize how bad it had gotten till I was over there earlier this year. And just using just about any sort of like browser, it's like, it's like a tax on your user experience that, I don't remember it being that bad a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, everybody's through threat of prosecution had to ask people to opt in and then also record the fact that you asked them to opt in. And then there are oxymoronic points, which are you allowed to store the data that where they said no? So if a user says, no, I don't want you to track me, are you allowed to record their demand to not be tracked?
22.
And so that's the problem with this whole thing is there are gray areas which are not useful, especially if you're a small, medium-sized business. And the big, as I just said, all of the big platforms, they've got you anyway, like the moment you log in. So it's, you know, trying to put so many pop-ups around the internet to prevent people from tracking you doesn't seem like a good answer still, and they're carrying
a little bit. No, and I think, this was a story from Digiday, and they were talking about publishers being worried about data leakage and things like that related to cookies. And it's something we've talked about on the podcast before. So I would just kind of jet through it with the big takeaway that I would give to publishers. And I think, you know, what John was alluding to just a moment ago is that, you know, these things are this is welcome. I think big tech sold everybody cookies as being something that was going to be good for advertisers and publishers. And I don't know that we've gotten a advertising system that is as good as is promised. I don't think any advertisers are going to tell you that they fully trust that the audiences that they're buying are exactly as promised from the advertising platforms, from people like Google or Microsoft or you name it. And your space, you cookies have nothing to do with a publisher's business. That's what advertisers are telling you they want you to help them sell. So your space, the price of it shouldn't change. It's on the advertisers to figure out how they want to buy that space. Now, you being able to collect the data that says, like, this is my audience, we largely have had the tools that you need to sell your audience, generally for 20 years. Now, what makes your audience special? And if you want to do these, you know, sophisticated larger brand deals, there's, you're going to have to collect that. You're going to actually have to build a relationship with your audience. But those that do, you're going to be able to fetch a very pretty premium for it. And I think that, you know, that's the way it should be, because as an advertiser, that's where the value is. If you buy ads on a site that it doesn't matter to the audience if they get this information from your site or another site, like, why would an advertiser pay more for yours? But if the person on your site that they're advertising on is coming directly to you because they think of your site as an authority, the brand sort of gets a little bit of that shine, and they should need to pay a premium for that. So I think it just comes back to the fundamentals of publishing. And, you know, when it comes to third-party cookies, this is not the publisher's problem to worry about.
No, it's not. And I was talking about it earlier with one of the guys over here, one of our developers, and I was saying, isn't it funny that we have an auction, which depends on the appetite of the advertiser and their budget size to determine the price that they're going to pay. But there are so many, and whereas in e-commerce, there's a fixed price. And now you're seeing in e-commerce that there's variable pricing. So, you know, Amazon are really good at predicting the price of, you know, a TV for Black Friday, for example. And they've got the scraping and processor power to be able to go around the internet and to be able to predict what is a price that they can put up that will get them the volume that they want to get. So there's like a data advantage for them. But in terms of publishers, they still don't have the other side. You know, we've always talked about that. You know, what's missing for the publishers? And what would be fairer would be to have fixed prices, you know, buy it now prices for advertising based on previous value rather than just a race to the bottom, which of course is what a bid floor is for. But bid floors only work if the advertisers have all the information they need to make the decision. So it's kind of like there's someone in the middle holding us all apart. And, you know, guess who it is?
Yeah.
I'm getting cynical, Tyler. It's been a while. I wondered why I wasn't it. Yeah.
So our listeners will definitely, you can tell that John and I have been not only working together for a long time, but also been in this space for a long time. Because I often say the exact same thing to producer Manny here whenever we're going through the news of the day. As I'll say, yeah, you know, am I wrong here? I'm a little bit more cynical, you know, bring me back to a more positive look. Because, I think it's pretty common. I had a reporter from Adweek tell me recently when we were discussing, we were talking about ads.txt. And they said, you know, I haven't been a reporter in this space for very long, but I don't know that I've ever experienced an industry where everyone was so cynical. And I'm like, everybody is. And I think I think a lot of that just comes from there's just so many middlemen and so many there's just so many gray areas in this space that everybody has to operate in that I think everyone has been promised these sort of like the cleaning up of things and a clearer picture of how a lot of things work for a long time. And I think that skepticism and sort of like it is really just understanding that that's a feature, not a bug. And the promise itself is, you know, like perpetual.
Yeah. And I mean, trying to see the sort of the upside here, I would say as information itself becomes the commodity or because of GPT and those large language models that are able to bring in a lot of data and to be able to make sense for it, the stuff that's going on in the page, so all the JavaScript, all the stuff that has to load, is going to become less important. And it could be that there will be, I mean, who knows what the future monetization of the internet's going to be. But I would say there is some hope there that there will be the opportunity for publishers to own versions of large language models that they have as a proprietary sort of ownership over, as they do a website. Now, getting into the realms of science fiction for the internet now, but, you know, I see it as there is some hope there because we need the internet. You know, giving it up to large language models and then just saying, well, nobody's going to produce any more content so we don't get paid. I mean, that could be the case for content, but what about e-commerce? What about services? What about government sites? Like, there's got to be a reason for putting things on the internet. There's there's got to be a volume that comes out. So I think it will be, but I don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, and I think that that's got to be the patience that listeners, publishers, and anybody with it within the space that wants to be successful. I think you have to be really careful about making big faith leaps right now and where you think the direction of things might go. There will be plenty of people to take those leaps, but I think that there's a difference between taking a risk and trying to predict the future. And I think you can get into a lot of trouble trying to predict the future. A risk is calculated. It means that you have something that you want to do that you think is innovative, and innovation is good. And sometimes you fail. But I think trying to get ahead by observing someone else's innovation and trying to tag along, you know, I think you forego many of the benefits and accept all of the same risks. So I think the discipline is being able to kind of work out of a things might change sort of attitude and being able to adapt. So I think it's that adaptability that we've seen publishers have. I mean, how many publishers do you know that have been, you know, on the web publishing for 20 plus years, and some of them not even the most sophisticated, but they've found ways to adapt to the areas where it's the most important.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't forget that it's going to be very hard for these large language models to generate and create good audio, good video. That's going to be later. I think it's the text or the sort of textual stuff it's going to be harder for publishers to protect themselves from, in terms of we want to get in there. It's the same with Google, isn't it? You want to get indexed, you want to be in the rankings, but also there's a reason for you wanting that, is you want to get some benefit.
You know, something I was describing to somebody the other day, and I'll transition this to our last story of the day out of respect for time, because I know we wanted to kind of talk a little bit more about GPT, and we're on the subject of AI already. But, you know, one of the things that I find really interesting, and I was explaining to somebody the other day, is, you know, in many ways, it's not too different from, you know, the way that the internet works in general, where if you think about the impact of large language models and will I still write articles in 5 to 10 years, and will articles, you know, or blogs or whatever even be needed? It's kind of like saying, you know, I'm a book publisher and will books still be needed? And the answer is the question, I guess, is kind of the wrong one if you think about it, because, you know, what is a publisher changed in that equation? But realistically, many of the people that would have been, you know, in the book publishing industry are now on the web, or maybe even started in the web, or there were writers, journalists. They actually weren't even involved in the quote unquote like publishing side of like written content. And my point in saying this is that articles, digital, are just the formats. What is it that people want to get out of an article? Well, it could be a lot of things. It could be entertainment. It could be information. It could be news. Who knows? But that information, if you're the person that's providing it today as a publisher, there's no reason why you won't provide it in the future. And I imagine that future is a digital one. How that integrates with large language models, we don't know yet. But a large language model is a worthless piece of software devoid of any training data. And, you know, every millisecond, there's new information generated by the world, right? Something is happening somewhere, and that is not recorded by machines. Until we have, you know, this dystopian future where everyone is just covered with cameras, where the machines are recording literally everything that happens at every second, we're going to be in a situation where human beings are the machine's best mechanism for collecting information and data that we all want. And I think if you're a publisher today, there's no chance that the role that you serve and the value that you provide to all people is going to go away. It's like you said, you know, what does that look like? We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And I think that's what makes people afraid. But don't forget, then there will be creation of value as well as destruction of value. And it's making sure that your business, whatever it might be, is on the creation side and get there as quickly as you can, which is why, you know, obviously using AI, using these tools, and even though I'm sure some of my listeners will be thinking, well, maybe I should spend some time. You know, I honestly, I think with us being quite close to it, we forget a lot of people out there aren't using it. They're just not. They're thinking, oh, it's kind of a useful tool. But all this sort of stories of apocalyptic, you know, end of the internet stuff. I think if you remember when, I do remember when video came out, I said, what's going to happen to the movie theaters? And we're going to shut down. Yeah. People just getting their movies. Didn't happen. It sort of coexisted. And of course now, you know, video's gone. So DVD's gone. I just went and I was clearing out my old house and we got rid of big box of DVDs. Like just nobody to watch those. Don't even have a DVD player. Like who does? It's just the content's changed all that.
And sometimes it takes industries a second to adapt. Because if you look at the music industry, it's probably the best example. Whenever it was disrupted from, you know, like things like, you know, like a Napster came along, and then all of a sudden people were like, wait a minute, music is free now on the internet? Screw paying for this, you know, like record. And you can kind of see the music mediums, the quality, all this stuff, like in a linear growth over time, revenue. So the music industry was a healthy, like good industry to be in that was looking very promising. And then you have Napster, you have LimeWire, you have these, you know, BitTorrent style downloads on the internet. And, you know, the industry just got flatlined almost. You know, it's like there's no money in music anymore. And artists were concerned and worried. But if you look probably about 10 years after that, it goes back to, it's like a stock market crash where it's like, okay, now it's back on track. But now you've seen pretty much over the last 5 or 6 years, an exponential growth curve where you just see it hockey stick up. And it's like, the industry matured and figured out how to basically like monetize that. The music industry was a corrupt one where you had a few number of artists and labels making the majority of the money. And now you have more artists making a larger percentage of revenue and a larger percentage of artists that share in that entire sort of like pie of the music industry with fewer middlemen. And I think that it's that maturity that sort of like comes out of an industry being kind of like woken up by these technologies, which should disrupt, you know, what is hopefully inconsistencies and incongruencies and efficiency and stuff like that, that naturally sort of brew up whenever you have people that have antitrust-ish practices.
It's interesting because, well, you remember my son, but you probably remember him being like this tall, but he's 18, 6'2". Just started it at music college. And, you know, when I tell people that, they go, oh my goodness, you must be really worried for it. And I said, no, because he's actually at a college that the tutors, it's called BIM, it's just based in Brighton, okay, but they have very forward thinking tutors and they are still working in the industry and they're teaching from experience. So it's not just performance, you know, like gigs and recording artists and getting money from Spotify. It's actually music in the movie industry and the games industry. And so he's basically doing a degree in the music industry. But again, it's gonna get disrupted. But I said, have they been teaching you AI? I think he was back last week, and he said, yeah, all the time. They're talking about it all the time, and we're learning how to, because if you want to make money as a band these days, you have to do live gigs because that's the way that you make money. And look at Taylor Swift, right? You know, they've been booking out like movie theaters with the latest tour. And what is that? The most profitable tour of all time? Like, you know,
that thing is incredible to me. I'm very impressed.
It's amazing, isn't it? What a business for it. And it just shows you then that all of the doomsayers, you know, yes, not all of the money is going to filter down to all of the artists, but they have a shot at using AI to create new music that, of course, is likely to get included in training data for more AI, which, of course, you would think, oh, no, that's terrible. But if you make friends with it, you can see you can still do the thing. It's just, where is the money flowing? So for them, it's things like merch and doing gigs and in the sync session where you can all the other stuff that you've got to do. But AI is not going to replace people going to gigs. Like, people still want to go. And so it's just that the world is going to change. that's not going to suddenly grind. You get a whole industry that's not going to grind for.
I have this, I just get this gut feeling like this music thing might stick around. I think people like it.
Yeah, exactly. People sitting in their cars are like, should I listen to a podcast? And should I?
Yeah. Driving quiet. Yeah. You know, this music thing was a fad. It's like the oldest books that we have are like half of them are filled with just like songs. So you kind of mentioned the using AI and making friends with it. I think that there's a lot of headlines drive me crazy these days because I do feel like that many of them are just done to sort of like create sort of like a fear of AI. You know, that sort of line even of itself, it's like make friends with it. It's like you just immediately imagine the Terminator holding like, you know, a rifle and just being like, I could be on your side. I could get the other humans to do what you say, you know?
Judas. Yeah.
But our last story is the one that you alluded to at the very beginning of our podcast, where we have OpenAI's GPT store, which they just launched, but it allows you to train basically AI models, GPT, OpenAI's large language model on your own data system. Basically, you're creating a plugin for GPT that is unique and special for you. And I don't know if you followed this or you saw much about the announcement, but what are your thoughts on this?
Do you know what it reminded me of, Todd? It was when Facebook opened their platform to developers and used to have that thing every year with F8 and people who don't remember this. It was, I think, one of the reasons why Facebook suddenly pulled ahead of all of the other social networks that were out there because they opened the platform, or at least said, build games, attract people, we'll share user data with you as well, which became controversial later. But this feels like another moment like that where you've got developers around the world clamoring. Apparently there's 2 million developers working with GPT. And you imagine all of the various areas, it might be all the way from, you know, pharmaceuticals to booking engines to support features to music. Like, it's just every single niche, the law, cannot fail to completely revolutionize the way that lawyers work. Because if you think about it, you're paying a lawyer a lot of money, you know, to read stuff.
That one in doctors, they both can, as soon as the machines are ready.
Yeah. The thing that I noticed was the translation into lots of different languages, and it's really, really, really good. And if you think about the health benefits abroad, if you go get to a health professional and ask an AI and it can speak your own language, and it's, you can probably upload a picture of something and it can give me some sort of rough diagnosis much probably better than you can by reading websites and trying to translate it. Like, it's, there's going to be lots of benefits here for humanity, Jay.
And there's something to be said for wisdom and experience. And I think that's why they call things like a medical practice in medicine. But you do have these inherent biases, and you have sort of, you know, those things that are benefits of, like, you know, a wise, you know, doctor that's been practicing medicine for a long time are also weaknesses in many ways too, because I mean, I think every health professional would tell you that it's very difficult to keep up to date on the latest, you know, best of care practices and things like that. And it's not to say that a machine even has to replace it, even in the short term. It's just that these things can be made so much better. And I think that we will look back in 10 to 15 years and almost sort of laugh at sort of how, like, our crude rudimentary solutions, that the idea that people were afraid that some of these things would go away. I find that with the OpenAI store thing, you brought up a great point, which is if you look at Google, Salesforce, Facebook, all these like giant behemoths, they grew in popularity before they became the behemoth that we think of today in a business sense. And that's because once they kind of hit that critical mass in terms of users, they allowed developers, allowed businesses to come and build their business on top of them. And you can look at, you know, someone like Google, where all publishers that have a website, like, the majority of them, I would say, are built partially on the back of Google, because look, there's this great platform you can come and get up on and, you know, like, take away the ability to search the internet. How many publishers are going to find a way to connect with an audience? I mean, How would you even do it? Without
email?
A search engine at all, you know?
Yeah. So I do think there's going to be, like your example with the doctor. I think it's a supplementary tool. So my cousin's a doctor, and I asked her this same question, and she said one of the things is, because she's been a general practitioner for 25 years, and she said sometimes it's not what they come in complaining about; it's the questions that you ask around them that would be on the other things. And AI doesn't sound like it would be an instant replacement for a doctor, obviously, but it would definitely be a great tool, because you could say, you know, I'm a bit stumped here. I wonder what this is, and ask it, and you know, upload an image or whatever. But I mean, coming back to publishing, I think there's going to be so much opportunity here. It's so, I mean, I've been looking at it, thinking, what can we build? And we've only got a whole host of AI tools now, but with this latest one, they have a code analyzer. They in the API so that you can, it's just going to be so easy to build applications. It's going to be really, like, there's going to be the opportunity for publishers who have a lot of content. I think we're only scratching the surface of what could be generated.
Yeah, and I think your point, you actually connected two things that. I'll end with this, because I think it's where I think the application that you discussed about it being a tool is probably most important for publishers right now. And I think it applies to all things. And your example on the doctor saying it's the questions that you ask. Machines are really good at being able to take the revelation of ChatGPT is that it communicates the way that humans do and understands sort of like the communication. The problem is whenever you have a non-expert, take medicine, for example, someone comes in, they're complaining about, they've got a headache, and it's like, okay, what are all the reasons you can have a headache? You go through the whole host of them, but nothing solves the problem. But the reason is because they're complaining about a headache, which maybe is a result of, it's a cascade effect where it's like there's actually another problem. The problem may be that they have a blood clot in their, in their leg, but you don't feel that there, and you don't know to ask that question. You don't even know that that's related, and so you spend a lot of time. And this happens to people with doctors as well. But the experience of a doctor currently, and this is the role that humans play with content as well, is like, what are the questions that haven't been asked yet? What is missing that needs to be created, needs to be provided, needs to be asked, because everything else exists already. It's like there are answers to these questions, but when individuals or industries or spaces, or there's these gaps in content that exist out on the web, when they don't exist, that's the job. You're an explorer. That's what the value of having publishers are right now, is like, you're creating content for people. People want that content. If you're just recreating content that already exists, there's no value there. And I think it's the same reason why no one is trying to build a Google clone, because it's like, why would you? Google already exists, But we'll end with that. But John, any parting words for our publishers, or maybe longtime listeners that are going to navigate these next, interesting years as technology plows ahead forward?
I would say don't lose hope. The huge thing in our favor, for those of us all working within the web and working to industry the web, is that user behavior isn't going to change overnight. So we have a long time to figure all this out, and there's new monetization opportunities coming up. I feel actually probably, I think you said it on that podcast, I don't know, a few weeks ago, when you were saying at the beginning of the year, you're feeling a bit low about it. This looks like it's going to be problematic. I feel a lot more positive now than I did back in February, for example. Just because I've been working on it and within it for 6 months, I feel quite, I would say not 100% confident. There's still a little bit of scaredy cat going on inside me, but I feel like I could, providing you embrace things and don't try to wish things were different. You just accept the change and you lean in on it and you get good at what using GPT and other tools. There will be huge opportunities. So that's how we're going to leave it lossless. And also thank you. Yes.
Yeah. And I like something I heard. I'll steal it from Sam Altman because I heard him talking about it the other day. And it's generally, I've kind of flipped like you have, where it's like, maybe more bad than good is my fear. But I've switched to sort of believing something I heard Altman say, which was AI is going to do a lot of good in the world, but that doesn't mean no bad. And that's kind of how I look at publishing. It's going to do a lot of good, but that doesn't mean that there's not going to be casualties. And I would say, if you're listening to this podcast, I say it all the time, but you're on the right track because you're trying to keep your finger on the pulse. And this is a very large space. And I do think that trying to just make sure that you're educated and understand the direction of things and being out in front, you're so far ahead of, you know, the middle of the pack that I think that, yeah, you'll find your way for sure. And I'll leave our listeners with that. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Publisher Lab. If you have comments, if you want to see John back on the show and us to drag him out of the closet every now and then more often, let us know at thepublisherlab.org. Questions, comments, you know, we'll take anything and we'll discuss it on the show. We love those. So thank you very much. And we'll catch you next time on the Publisher Lab.